Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group Podcast, your source for current issues within the legal practice. Today, the Federalist Society's Financial Services and E-Commerce Practice Group is hosting a panel discussion on the new FDIC Deposit Insurance Assessment Rule. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speakers.
Welcome, everyone. This is John Douglas of Davis Polk. I've been asked to moderate what I hope will be a very interesting and fascinating discussion involving the FDIC's final rule on assessments, dividends, the assessment base, and large bank pricing for its deposit insurance fund. It has been really a remarkable transformation of the way the FDIC has handled its assessments, mandated mostly by Dodd-Frank, but also on the FDIC's own initiative. I am pleased to be joined today by Chris Cole and Bert Ely. Chris is Senior Vice President and Senior Regulatory Counsel of the Independent Community Bankers of America, where he focuses on deposit insurance issues, regulatory restructuring, safety and soundness, corporate governance, credit unions, capital requirements. Chris is the ICBA's staff liaison for the Regulatory Review Committee, the Mutual Bank Council, and the Large Community Bank Council. He was previously with First Virginia Banks, and prior to that served as counsel for the Marriott Corporation and with the Department of the Treasury. Bert Ely almost needs no introduction. He's been consulting on deposit insurance and banking issues since 1981. He was, interestingly enough, an early predictor of the S&L crisis and the taxpayer bailout of the FSLIC, and was also, interestingly enough, the first person to predict the non-crisis in commercial banking. He continuously monitors conditions in the banking industry and monetary policy, and has focused recently on banking problems, the crisis in housing and finance, Fannie and Freddie, and most recently has been involved in advising clients on the implementation and consequences of Dodd-Frank. Both Chris and Bert are frequent speakers, commentators, and are great experts on this subject, and I'm delighted to have both of them join us here. So what we're really going to talk about is what the FDIC did on February 7th of this year, when it approved its final rule on assessments, dividends, the assessment base, and large bank pricing. As I indicated, a lot of this was mandated by Dodd-Frank that required the FDIC to change the way it calculated or change the assessment base. And part of it was the FDIC's ongoing efforts that began earlier to try to figure out in its mind a different way to assess large banks. Chris, I'm going to let you start and talk a little bit about your take on what the FDIC did and what it means and what why it's so important.
Yeah, thank you, John. Thank you, Bert. And thank you to the Federalist Society. I think this is a great idea to have this podcast and discuss deposit insurance reform. ICBA, the trade association I work for, was absolutely thrilled with the change in the assessment base. So we liked very much what the FDIC did to implement, as John pointed out, implementing the statutory change of Dodd-Frank. In fact, we thought that Section 331 of the Dodd-Frank Act, which mandates this change in the assessment base, was probably the most successful part of the entire bill. Maybe the other successful part being raising the insurance deposit insurance coverage from $100,000 to $250,000 was equivalent to this, but this was a great achievement. And the reason we think this was a great achievement was that it imposed a degree of parity that was not in the insurance system before that. We figure that reforming this insurance system by using the new assessment base, and let me explain, the assessment base is now going to be total consolidated assets minus tangible or tier one capital, whereas the old assessment base was based solely on total domestic deposits. We think using the total consolidated assets minus tangible or tier one capital will bolster, or not only bolster, the deposit insurance fund, but it lowers premiums for community banks by about $4.5 billion over the next 3 years. We think this is will really impose a degree of parity, as I say, that wasn't there before. Under the old system, banks with less than $10 billion, which is usually what we like to call as the community bank, the bank that has assets in less than $10 billion, paid approximately 30% of total FDIC assessments, even though they held only 20% of the total bank assets. And while community banks fund themselves 85 to 95% with domestic deposits, for banks with more than $10 billion in assets, the figure is 52%. Thus, while community banks pay assessments on nearly their entire balance sheets, large banks have been paying only on half their balance sheet. So you can see the new assessment system is a much fairer system for dealing with deposit insurance reforms. Again, I think we're talking about a $4.5 billion savings. And I must admit, it's not just banks over, must note that it's not just banks under $10 million that's going to be impacted. I mean, we have some banks that, say, BB&T size, lots and lots of banks that are going to be impacted favorably by this change in the assessment base. A much more favorable system, and Bert and I will debate the whether it is fair or not, but I think overall it's a much better way of gauging the risks to the deposit insurance fund. That's all I have to say at this point.
Good. Bert, I know you have something to say.
Just a few words. John, thank you very much for moderating this call. And Chris, thank you for being on it with me. First, just to pick up on a couple of things that Chris said, in terms of the broadening of the assessment base, a key thing it did is it brought into the assessment base liabilities that are not insured by the FDIC, and specifically deposits in foreign offices, which admittedly community banks don't have much of, as well as secured borrowings, notably Federal Home Loan Bank advances. So what we've done is we've moved away from a system that where the premiums assessed bore some relationship to the risk that the FDIC incurs. And interestingly enough, while the assessment base was total domestic deposits, only insured deposits are theoretically protected. In recent years, in 93% of the bank failures, the FDIC protected uninsured deposits also. So we really had a very close correlation between what was being assessed, that is total domestic deposits, and what is being protected against loss is total domestic deposits in most bank failures. So we have a dramatic departure in this legislation from a close link between premium assessed and what was being protected. In moving to this new assessment system, there is one fundamental problem, and that's a matter of legality. The FDIC, in setting its new assessment rates based on this new base, and these new rates came into effect on April 1 of this year, clearly contravened Section 1817B1C of the Federal Deposit Insurance Act, which states that the risk-based assessment system that the FDIC has means a system for calculating a depository institution's assessment based on the probability that the deposit insurance fund will incur a loss with respect to that institution, taking into account various attributes. So we now have an assessment system that not only assesses on liabilities that the FDIC cannot protect, and many of these, of course, are secured liabilities, but also we have an assessment system that has departed from this requirement that it bear, that the assessment on a particular institution bears some relationship to the probability that that institution might fail. And this is really quite significant when you look at what the FDIC's loss experience has been. Chris mentioned that community banks, those under $10 billion in assets, paid 30% of the premium, and this will clearly lower it. However, it's interesting in recent years, since 2007, when the current spate of failures began, that 60% of the loss that the FDIC has incurred in failed banks have been in banks under $10 billion in assets. Arguably, the premiums have not been high enough on banks under $10 billion in assets, and yet we have a new system in place that further lowers their premiums, further increases the disparity between the amount of premium income the FDIC will collect on banks under $10 billion versus the amount of loss they will take. My estimate is, based on FDIC data, that under this new assessment system, banks over $25 billion in assets will pay close to three-quarters, at least initially, they'll pay close to three-quarters of the total assessment income that the FDIC will be collecting. And yet, in recent years, during this recent round of failures, there wasn't a single bank over $25 billion that paid. So the banks that will pay three-quarters of the premiums have incurred no loss for the FDIC. In effect, what the new system does is dramatically increase the cross-subsidy in deposit insurance from large to small institutions. And I question the public policy wisdom of that. Further, although I'm not an attorney, I've looked closely at this issue and quite frankly was hoping that somebody, one of the large banks or an association of large banks, would sue the FDIC to block this, because this new assessment system clearly is in violation of the Federal Deposit Insurance Act. For a variety of reasons, probably more political than legal, no suits were filed, probably will not be. And so now we're in a situation that the new assessment system, which is both the base that's being assessed as well as how the premium rates are calculated, is in place, and it likely is going to stay in place. So now the public policy question is, what are going to be the consequences of this new assessment system and, in effect, this new tax on non-deposit liabilities? For that's what it really is a tax on non-deposit liabilities. And I just want to toss out some potential implications of this. And as often the case with law, there'll be unintended consequences, some potentially negative, and to some extent we may see actually a boomerang effect back on the community banks, where they may eventually rue the day that they succeeded in the broadening of the assessment base. And let me just run through these very quickly, and I'll conclude. First, non-deposit liabilities are now more expensive liabilities relative to deposits. And when you add in the liability tax that they're now subject to. And so this has created the potential for a greater competition for domestic deposits. That is, we may find that the larger banks, those over including the mega banks, will actually become more aggressive in their interest rates in bidding for domestic deposits, driving up deposit costs for all banks and harming community banks in that manner. Second, community banks have been heavy users of Federal Home Loan Bank advances. Federal Home Loan Bank advances are now going to be taxed. And so Federal Home Loan Bank advances are now basically a less attractive funding source for community banks than they were before. And what this may do is accelerate further the shrinkage of the advances that Federal Home Loan Banks have been making, which raises some interesting issues about the profitability and survivability of the Federal Home Loan Bank. So the community banks may have shot themselves in the foot in two ways. Number one, by effectively stimulating increased competition to attract deposits, and number two, by making Federal Home Loan Bank advances less attractive as a funding source for community banks, further squeezing their net interest margin. Now, there are also some other factors to take into account here. First of all, large U.S. banks have lost competitiveness outside the United States with regard to funding their non-U.S. Assets because not just are their deposits in foreign offices now subject to this tax, but also any other borrowings they have outside the United States. And yet the banks chartered in other countries that they're competing with head-to-head aren't subject to that tax. So what we've done is we've put U.S. banks at a competitive disadvantage outside the United States. Now, how much business this will impact, how this will impact them, I don't know. But to the extent that they are less competitive and their balance sheets shrink as a result, this will cause more of the FDIC premium burden to shift back onto community banks. Second of all, it seems to me it's quite feasible that a U.S. bank holding company with substantial foreign activities might take all those foreign activities and shift them out of their U.S. bank subsidiary into a non-U.S. bank subsidiary, let's say a bank that's headquartered in London. And that would shift, and they would do this so that they could compete on a level playing field against their foreign competition. And what that would do is shrink the asset base, significantly shrink the asset base of their U.S. bank subsidiary, shifting even more premium liability back onto community banks. Finally, what this tax on non-deposit, non-domestic deposit liabilities has done has increased the competitiveness or given a competitive edge to foreign banks operating inside the United States. And not to pick on the Canadians, but Canadian banks have substantial activities here in the United States. It becomes quite feasible for them to take a U.S. loan they've made and, in effect, sell it upstream to their Canadian parent, fund it with U.S. dollars through the Canadian parent, and in that way avoid the U.S. tax on non-deposit liabilities. And it's going to be interesting to see how this plays out, keeping in mind that a number of the Canadian banks have U.S. retail operations. They compete for a lot of the same business customers, particularly, that U.S. community banks compete against. And what we might find is that they will actually be taking business away from community banks because they're able to book it in Canada or over in the U.K. or wherever, and thereby avoid a tax that community banks are subject to. So let me just conclude by saying that this change in assessment base effectively has put a tax on non-domestic deposit liabilities. It is perfectly normal, rational for organizations and individuals to try to minimize their tax liabilities, and we may see them do that in ways that are not only harmful to the U.S. banking system, but in particular harmful to community banks. John, that concludes my remarks.
Okay, Chris, any sort of thoughts in response to Bert?
Yeah, in fact, do we have another hour here that we can talk about this?
We don't have an hour, but don't.
let me try to summarize how I would respond to Bert, who made some excellent points. But let's first talk about what his latter points, which was that this really was going to hurt community banks. Believe me, we've looked at all the community banks, all the banks under $10 billion, even those with some high secured liabilities, some Federal Home Loan Bank advances. And so far, we have seen very few that are going to have a worse or higher assessment rate under the new assessment base than they did under the old system. You remember that just taking in consideration the base rates for risk institutions, Category 1 institutions, which are 12 to 16 basis points, those went down as a result of the FDIC's actions from 12 to 16 to 5 to 9. It was a dramatic decrease. And, you know, a week goes by where I don't have an institution telling me that their community bank telling me that their assessments now have gone down 40%, 50%. even some of the New England institutions that have high secured liabilities and Federal Home Loan Bank advances are telling me, yeah, they're still seeing declines. They may not be down in the 30% range, but they're around 10 or 12%. The only institutions I've seen that have had actual increases have been those with subsidiaries, leasing subsidiaries, and since the new rules require that you consolidate your bank subsidiaries and include those as your part of your asset base, then those have had some trouble. But I have not seen any of that. Now your second point, Bert, there's going to be a shift in funding, so that there'll be a lot more competition with respect to domestic deposits now, and we've heard that argument before. We've heard American Bankers Association has made that argument, and that's one that we'll just have to see. I certainly, in this low interest environment, I have not seen any start to see any semblance of that. And as you know, the rates went in effect April 1st, the second quarter. So I haven't seen any impact of that. And I actually think the bigger worry, and we don't want to get off on another subject, but I think the bigger worry as far as interest rates concerned are going to be the deregulation or the repeal of Regulation Q, which goes into effect July 1. I think banks are. That's when you'll see interest rates do go up for deposits, but that's another story. So I'm still skeptical, but I don't have any quantitative evidence to refute that. But I would say let's just see. We'll look at the call reports at the end of the year, and we'll see if there is a different mix of funding sources. Whether the big banks do change their funding sources, and then we can come back and have this conversation here in another year. Maybe this time next year, and say, well, is Bert's predictions true that the big banks have shifted and they're now out of the Fed funds market and out of the repo market, say, and moving into and foreign deposits, and now are shifting their funds over into the domestic market. And furthermore, I think that I think the reason why you're not going to see a lawsuit over this thing is that it's very, very simple. The only reason why the large banks escaped a catastrophe here was with bailout funds. Citibank is still bailed out. Citibank is still significantly controlled by the federal government, up to 30%. Of his stockholder of the federal government. The Citibank was a big risk to the insurance system. Now, the Deposit Insurance Fund did not bail out Citibank, but would have had to if it had come to that situation. And I think that that would have included many of the other institutions that went under WaMu. It's because of the unprecedented government intervention in the form of programs like the Temporary Liquidity Guarantee Program, the Debt Guarantee Program, and particularly the FDIC Guarantee Program, Tillygap, TALF. It was this unprecedented amount of bailout and intervention by the federal government that propped the big banks up. So to come in a lawsuit and say, hey, by this doing the shifting these to a different system of assessing risks, this is not fair. I think that's going to be it's going to be very difficult to convince a judge that yes, our community banks are riskier than Citibank and some of the other large banks. And as far as assessing all assets as opposed to just assessing domestic deposits, it's true. I mean, domestic deposits are what the system is covering. But, as Sheila Bair has pointed out, and by the way, Chairman Bair is a strong advocate of this change, she's saying, the FDIC has always covered secured liabilities. And so this will now be covered as part of the change. And so all liabilities, all funding mixes will now be covered as part of that assessment base. And that will reflect a better way of assessing risk on depository institutions.
Okay, well, let me respond. This is Bert, and let me respond to several Chris's points. Time, of course, doesn't allow a full rebuttal. But first of all, in terms of what the impact is going to be, we're only a couple of months in this new taxing regime. It may take a couple of years before we begin to really see the effects of this, particularly if some of the larger banks start to restructure themselves so that they put their foreign activities in a foreign chartered bank that would not be subject to this liabilities tax. The second thing is that to the extent that foreign banks operating in the United States gain a competitive advantage, or they have gained a competitive advantage over U.S. banks and are able to utilize that, it'll be difficult to see that effect in the call report data, except possibly that we see a slowing rate of growth of bank assets in the United States. And again, it's going to take a couple of years for that to take effect. With regard to systemic risk, which we haven't talked about before, my concern is that one of the unintended consequences of this is to the extent that the funding of U.S. assets gets driven out of U.S. banks into foreign domiciled banks, that actually, I think, complicates the issue of managing systemic risk because those foreign-based institutions, of course, will not be subject to the same kind of oversight from the U.S. government that is the case today. With regard to the whole issue of bailout, first of all, it is important to point out that the federal government will make money on the funds that it invested in U.S. Banking companies. Even it looks like they'll make money on their investment in Citigroup. So, far from being a loss to taxpayers, it looks like it's been a profit. But coming back to the issue of litigation, when Congress expanded the assessment base, it had an opportunity to change the Federal Deposit Insurance Act to say that the assessment system didn't have to reflect the probability that an individual bank would fail at a loss to the deposit insurance fund. So leaving aside issues of fairness, the fact is that the statutory requirement is very clear that a particular institution's assessment is to reflect its probability of causing a loss to the deposit insurance fund. And in fact, large institutions, those with more than $25 billion, have not caused losses to the deposit insurance fund in recent years. And so that, as I say, the unfairness of the assessment system has actually increased in the context of how the statute is written. And again, I would hope that someday we will have a test on that, a court test, but doesn't look like that's going to happen anytime soon. That I'll conclude my rebuttal there. And John, I look forward to your questions and a further discussion with Chris about this.
I'm interested in this discussion of large bank failures. And maybe Chris, you mentioned Washington Mutual, and Bert, you talked about institutions over $25 billion not costing the FDIC fund anything. Let's tease that out a little bit. I mean, why Washington Mutual was a $300 billion and change institution? Why didn't it cost the FDIC anything?
This is Bert. Just to jump in, it appears that the regulators dealt with that quickly enough and were able to sell it to J.P. Morgan Chase at a price that basically meant no loss to the FDIC in terms of protecting all the depositors in Washington Mutual. A significant amount of loss, of course, was borne by the holding company that owned Washington Mutual Federal Savings Bank. So to the extent that there was a loss, it was borne by stockholders, and effectively absorbed by the premium that J.P. Morgan Chase was willing to pay.
Hey, John, just one point on that.
Fortunately,
you had a buyer for WaMu, you know, and my concern is that in the future, with a more concentrated financial market that you have now, when a institution, say the size of WaMu, let's say, for instance, a BB&T or a SunTrust or even a sovereign bank or a PNC, an institution like that that needs a buyer, are there going to be buyers there willing to take over those institutions? And I think in the future there are going to be real threats that these big banks' failures are going to rest on the deposit insurance fund and on the rest of the industry, and that I would just point that out.
Well, this is Bert to jump in on that point,
yep.
Except that to the extent that you have one of these SIFIs, significantly important financial institutions, fail, and any type of special assessment kicks in to cover that loss, which of course has actually been in the law since 1991, then that is not going to be a burden on a deposit insurance fund. And I keep coming back to how the statute reads, and that is probability that the deposit insurance fund will incur a loss. This is not to say that there won't be losses that have to be picked up otherwise, but Congress left that language in place. It had an opportunity in the Dodd-Frank Act to modify it, and it didn't. And so, I mean, I hate to you know, keep bringing statutory language into play, but in fact, that's how the law reads. And so that's why you only can focus on what will the probability of loss be to the deposit insurance fund, not what the probability of loss is, period.
It is interesting, and if I remember Washington Mutual correctly, let's say the institution was roughly $300 billion in assets. My recollection is that there were about 30 or 40 billion dollars of, you know, non-deposit, non-secured debt that was left behind in the receivership, and thus the delta between the assets and the deposit and secured liabilities that got protected was relatively large, about $40 billion. And so it seems to me that what the FDIC did was shift the cost of that failure, you know, first to the non-deposit, non-secured creditors, and then to the equity holders. Bert, does it strike you that if you were to look at a Citibank or a J.P. Morgan or something like that, that their asset liability mix might lead you to the same place, that if there were a failure, that those losses would be absorbed by, in essence, non-deposit and non-secured creditors?
John, you've raised an excellent point, and that is and this is where I think Sheila Bair gets it wrong. What doesn't get protected in a failed bank situation are unsecured liabilities, and you know, just such as unsecured borrowings. And what's interesting is, I believe it was 1993 or 94, in a budget bill of all things, Congress changed liquidation preference in failed bank receiverships and gave total domestic deposits a liquidation preference over other unsecured liabilities of the bank, such as borrowings. And so what comes into play in this situation is you have unsecured liabilities that are junior to the domestic deposits, junior to the FDIC's risk, and so they get wiped out completely in a failed bank situation before the first dollar of loss rises up to domestic deposits. And that is, an additional source of capital from the FDIC receivership perspective. And I think you're right that the same situation would exist in the larger banking companies, that you would have this kind of level of implicit capital in the form of unsecured liabilities, including foreign deposits, I might add, that would have to absorb loss before any losses reach the FDIC. possibly one of the unintended consequences of this change in assessment base is that banks will actually, almost from a cost standpoint, have to fund themselves increasingly with secured liabilities, because creditors are going to be unwilling to absorb, if you will, in their yield, this this tax on those unsecured liabilities, given that they will be getting no protection from it. So I failed to mention that earlier, but we may see a shift in the mix of secured versus unsecured non-deposit liabilities in banks because of these changes that have been put into place.
Chris, any thoughts on that? There seems to be a sense at the FDIC that the risk inherent in the big banks and the potential of loss generally would justify higher assessments on those institutions, and maybe that's right, maybe that's wrong. But Bert seems to point out that Bert points out that the statute sort of forces you to look at losses to the FDIC insurance fund itself associated with the failure.
Well, I think Bert makes a good point. I actually think that you need to look bank by bank. Not all the big banks are in the same boat. If you have a big bank with a lot of unsecured liabilities, Bert is correct. Those losses would be less. But you know, not everyone is in that same boat. Of all the banks over 50 billion, I doubt if anyone has as many unsecured liabilities as Citibank as a percentage of their total liabilities. I haven't looked at the statistics yet. Certainly in the regional bank systems, like the SunTrusts and the BB&Ts, which I'm more familiar with. I work briefly with BB&T. I know that their secured liabilities are still pretty high. With a BB&T, I think you have a much higher risk of some significant losses to the fund. So an asset-based system there is reflecting the risk to the fund. And, you know, we might also add to the fact for those listeners that there is an unsecured adjustment, unsecured liability adjustment that the FDIC gives you lower assessment rates if you do have unsecured liabilities. So, and that's to encourage the those types of liabilities.
Well, this is Bert. If I could just jump in on that point. First of all, with regard to the unsecured liability adjustment, critical question comes up right away is it sufficient? I haven't looked at it that closely, but I question whether it is. But coming back to Citibank and to the other large banking companies with substantial foreign deposits, it's important to keep in mind that those foreign deposits effectively are unsecured liabilities of the bank that are subject to a total wipeout before the first dollar of loss reaches domestic deposits insured or not. In other words, this is the change in depositor preference that's been in place now for almost 20 years, that domestic deposits, insured or not, are senior in liquidation preference to, among other things, foreign office deposits. It's always been a concern about what might happen in a big bank situation in terms of how foreign bank regulators might actually respond to that and might have some ring fencing of assets, foreign bank assets, to help protect those foreign deposits. And this it'll be interesting to see what happens both in terms of how the large U.S. banks try to restructure themselves and possibly come under increased pressure from foreign bank regulators to take their non-U.S. operations and charter them in a non-U.S. bank. And, of course, if we saw, and we'll use Citi as an example, a significant shift of its bank assets and liabilities that are outside the United States, and I think it's maybe on the order of 70% of its deposits are non-U.S. deposits, and shifted them into, let's say, Citibank UK, then what we would see is a substantial shrinkage in the size of Citibank N.A., which is the U.S. bank, or the U.S. chartered bank, and consequently a significant shrinkage in the FDIC assessment base, which for a given amount of premium income that the FDIC is seeking would force an increase in premium rates across the board and therefore to onto community banks. Again, restructuring a bank has lots of implications to it. It's something that's not going to happen quickly, but to the extent that that this liabilities tax becomes a burden on the and impairs the competitiveness of U.S. banks outside the United States, as I fear it will, then we will see these restructurings eventually. And again, the question is this what Congress really intended?
Another thing to bring up here is that we're overlooking here that the probability of loss is you're right, Bert. They're different for different banks, but you have to remember that these banks held a lot of derivative exposures, which got them into trouble. And it was these derivative activities that make them basically riskier than the normal community bank. And I would maintain that the probability of the big bank at this point, with the lower capital requirements that they have right now, that it's more probable that the big bank will fail than a small bank. And that's despite the fact that we're having, you know, we see small banks failing one or two a week here. It's still more probable that these guys, these large guys that engage in these very complex derivative transactions, are riskier to the entire system and to the deposit insurance fund than the small bank. But anyway, I also to interject here is I'm waiting to see what FSOC will do. You know, the Financial Stability Oversight Council is supposed to be squeezing the risk out of these large guys, and if they do. If, for instance, by imposing higher capital requirements and higher liquidity requirements, maybe at some point what Bert says is true, that we ought to go back and take another look at probability of loss to the fund. But that's a long, long way off.
Well, Chris, again, this is Bert jumping in here.
Yeah.
We have to, even today, draw a distinction between the risk of loss to the deposit insurance fund versus the risk of loss outside the deposit insurance fund. And again, the statute is very clear about this. It says risk of loss or probability of loss to the deposit insurance fund. And I would suggest that while, you know, leaving aside the question of the probability of failure and loss among these large banks, the question is, because of other mechanisms in place, will there be a loss to the deposit insurance fund? You know, I think it's important to keep in mind that Dodd-Frank put in place a separate special assessment provision comparable to what was in the fiduciary legislation back in 91 to assess losses in large institutions apart from and outside of the deposit insurance fund, which is why I will continue to draw the distinction between losses in large failed banks versus the losses in those banks that would be absorbed within the deposit insurance fund. And my sense is that large banks will not impose any loss on the deposit insurance fund because of this other assessment system.
And so your point, Bert, I think, is that were a Citi or a large money center bank to fail, there might be losses incurred by the government generally if it decides to protect non-deposit creditors, but that shouldn't affect the way the FDIC thinks about its statutory obligations?
That is correct.
Chris, do you have any thoughts with respect to that?
Well, I think that first of all, we need to know what kind of assessments they're going to set up here for the special assessment that you're referring to, how it's going to work before we can say that affirmatively is going to protect the depository insurance fund. And secondly, I think we also have to wait and see what FSOC's going to do to make, to squeeze the risk out of the large banks, to make the whole system safer. I still maintain that a typical community bank is a much safer bet and a much less risk to DIF than Citibank or any of the other large banks. But as I said, I'm open to reasoning here, and maybe in 2 or 3 years we can have this conversation again, and maybe I'll change my mind. But at this point, I'd have to say that that the larger banks pose a much, much greater risk to the deposit insurance fund than the community banks do.
So that raises an interesting question in my mind, and we've pointed out, and you've pointed out that, and Bert's pointed out that their funding is fundamentally different. They rely to a much heavier extent on non-domestic deposits. Their activities are fundamentally different. When you look at the swaps and derivatives business, the types of loans and services they provide are fundamentally different. Many of the advisory services and other things they do on a fee-generating basis are fundamentally different. And the way Dodd-Frank approaches them through the designation of SIFIs, the special assessments in loss, the FSOC rule, potential increased enhanced prudential standards, higher capital standards, and so on, really treats them differently than the community banks. I'm wondering whether at some point it might make sense just to go ahead and acknowledge that these are so different that the FDIC ought to have two insurance funds. Any reaction to that, Bert?
I'd like to hear Chris's first, and then I'll respond.
Two funds, no. To regulate it differently, yes. I think there's no question that we need a different set of regulations for the smaller institutions than we do for the larger institutions, a tiered set of regulations. And you're starting to see, there's been press reports that the banks around the size of PNC, the $50 billion to $200 billion range, are even saying, hey, listen, we're much different than the big Citibanks and Chases and the B of A's of the world. So I think a tiered regulatory system, yet. And the problem with having a double insurance fund, I don't think that really does anything for you risk-wise. You'll have to have a different set of assessments. I'd have to look at the entire scheme to really express an opinion, but right now I would say no. I would not be in favor. I just don't think it gets you anywhere to have two different funds.
Bert,
this is Bert. I can fully understand why Chris takes that position, because if there were two separate funds, the premium rates on community banks would be much higher than they would be on large banks, for the simple reason that, from a deposit insurance standpoint, it is small banks, not large banks, that cost the deposit insurance fund a lot of money. As I mentioned before, and this has been acknowledged over the years, there is a cross-subsidy in deposit insurance from large to small. If you have two separate funds, the cross-subsidy goes away, and the small banks, the community banks, up to $10 billion or size, or $25 billion in size, would have to carry the full burden, and they would be paying much higher premiums than the large banks. So that is why I can understand why the community banks would not want to give up that subsidy that they now enjoy, and a subsidy which has become even more substantial since April Fool's Day. The question of squeezing risk out of the large banks and having heavier capital requirements sounds appealing, but again, heavier regulation, higher capital requirements effectively is an increase in taxation of those banks. So then the question is, how will the financial markets respond to that? There's been a lot of concern about the growth in shadow banking in recent years, which shadow banking effectively is a regulatory arbitrage, or it exists because the financial engineers and the creative lawyers are arbitraging the banking regulation. The same thing will happen again to the extent that we try to impose more cost in the form of capital requirements and regulation on the large banks. Then the question is, what will become the new forms of shadow banking, and what will be the systemic risks that that will generate, not just within the United States, but within the global financial system? So I have a tremendous concern about this idea of we're going to squeeze risk out of the big banks. I keep thinking of squeezing a balloon. Squeeze one place, it bulges out someplace else. You squeeze enough, and the balloon pops. And I question whether that's the direction we want to move.
That sounds like another podcast to me. I think we should wrap up. Chris, any sort of closing comments from your perspective? This has been a really interesting dialogue.
Yeah, it has been interesting, and it's always fun to be with Bert, and really appreciate having him on here. And he does make some good points. I would just have to say that I still think that the change in the assessment base was good for the entire deposit insurance system and good for the entire financial industry. 99% of the community banks are seeing lower assessment rates, and I think a year from now they'll still see substantial lower assessment rates. And I think that's a good thing. I think that encourages community banking. It encourages stable domestic deposits, and I think it accurately reflects the risk that the institution has to the deposit insurance fund.
This is Bert. Just to wrap up, my issue is really not so much with the change in the assessment base. I didn't support it. I think Congress made a mistake, but that's the law of the land. What troubles me is that the FDIC, through its rulemaking process, did not compensate for that change in the assessment base by factoring in it into its statutory obligation to establish premium rates that reflect a in particular institution's risk of loss to the deposit insurance fund. In other words, there should have been a neutralizing effect that the FDIC would have adjusted the premium rates accordingly to, in effect, provide a credit, if you will, in the premium rate for secured liabilities. So that is the issue that I have, and so I'm concerned about the unintended consequences, likely largely negative, of this failure of the FDIC to properly adjust its assessment rates to take into account this congressional change in the assessment base.
Terrific. Chris and Bert, I want to thank both of you for what really has been an excellent discussion, and we may have to do this again in a year or so just to see what's happened. Thank you very much.
Good idea.
We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.